Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite little hangout where we talk politics. Brandon, we were off last week.
I know.
Did you have a good vacation?
It was great. Chicago, the weather was like, 109 degrees lower than Houston. So things are like a little bit warmer here, right?
Well, I hope our audience loved that awesome podcast takeover.
Wow. Right?
Talking about the city of Houston's travails in Harvey and the awesome recovery that is happening as we speak. It's a must listen. So please go out there and download that.
Such powerful stuff, right?
Yes, yes. So let's talk what we missed out on some stuff. Lots happening as always. But let's start off with the go international and bring it down to Texas.
Yeah.
Mike Pompeo is going to be testifying before the Congress related to the two Trump summits. Trump, of course, President Trump has been tweeting vociferously and crazily a bit about Iran and talking about war potentially. What's going on?
Yeah, there's been a lot of development since the summit with Vladimir Putin, which was the dominant part of the news that week. Well, we've shifted gears slightly to Iran. The president had a late night all caps tweet, which is never a good idea, right? After 11:30, don't tweet, and certainly don't do all caps. You know you're going to get in trouble. He tweeted essentially the following, that he was challenging the president of Iran, that they shouldn't threaten the U.S. and that such a threat may end up being violently problematic for them. The president of Iran retorted that this was the president playing with the lion's tail and that they shouldn't threaten Iran or else they will regret it. So what is your take on the president's sort of escalation of the Iranian situation?
So my view on it is that the president, every time there's some unpleasantness out in the news cycle,
right,
whether it's related to Russia, related to an investigation, suddenly a global crisis has occurred. So this was in response to the President Rouhani of Iran periodically makes these sort of pretty aggressive statements. Prior presidents have dealt with it, and they sort of brush them aside as sort of dealing to the internal politics of their country. President Trump decided to respond pretty angrily, an all caps tweet being essentially the equivalent of yelling at someone.
Right.
But to me, it was just, I think, just distraction, nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
Got momentarily off the news cycle, momentarily stopped talking about Russia. But lo and behold, we're back at it because the Congress has decided to look into and wants to know what was discussed at the summits because we don't have a formal briefing. And the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, is saying that there were deals cut.
These are worrisome, right? When you've got leaders that go into negotiation and there's no accountability in terms of what was recorded. And I think members of Congress are also equally worried. So this is why, as you say, there's been some calling to the carpet on this. To me, I think a lot of the saber rattling is going to backfire. All of the research we have on saber rattling shows that when presidents do it, it ends up hurting the U.S. economy. So if you've got people who don't have faith and don't have a desire to save money, then it's going to have ripple effects. So the more this happens, the worse it's going to get for the president at a period where, frankly, they need to have a good economy going into the election. But it seems to me that also plays into like the extremists in Iran, right, who want to ramp up the rhetoric. And the president maybe wants to have this battle, like you say, for, you know, purposes of trying to distract. But also, you know, there's a domestic value for him to do this. But it seems to me playing into the hands of like the Iranians who also want to ramp up that rhetoric for domestic reasons. So it's not clear what the trajectory is here, but it's definitely the case that it's going to have some short-term implications and possibly long-term implications.
Well, some of this saber-rattling, I think, was in part to distract from sort of two big bombshell things that came out. One was that the Carter Page, the FISA warrant that was issued that sort of led to the investigations came out, transcripts came out. Folks got an opportunity to look at exactly what the basis for the surveillance on Carter Page, the aide to President Trump during the campaign,
mm-hmm.
and the release, kind of bombshell release of Michael Mickey Cohen, his attorney, tapes that basically corroborate to some extent that the president of the United States, again, candidate Donald Trump, was aware that he was being blackmailed.
This is a bizarre story where the slivers of tape we have suggest that the team, along with Donald Trump and his agreement is going to pay off this woman, Karen McDougal, who had allegedly an affair with President Trump, then candidate Trump. This tape essentially documents them paying her off. There's, I guess, some question about what was said in one particular part where it was not clear if the president said that they should pay in cash or they should not pay in cash. So that's come down to a kind of particularly pointed issue with respect to what the president was ordering to have happen. But I think a couple of things are clear. One is that this scandal is enough horse tranquilizer to bring down any other president except Donald Trump, right? So to preview, actually, an episode we'll have upcoming, special scandal issue of Party Politics Podcast. We'll talk all about scandal. But in the meantime, there's something about President Trump that's unique in terms of how they deal with scandal. And I think the other fact is that Cohen is an awful lawyer. I mean, the president himself tweeted, why would you record your client in this way and then make it available? The whole thing is pretty nasty, but I think it does show that there's vulnerabilities there for the president. And as these things continue to build, you're going to have potential problems of some coalition, especially when it comes to women and college-educated voters.
Well, I think that the obvious answer to why he taped him is for exactly this situation. Because Michael Cohen, I think, anticipated the potential of being caught in something that he was not didn't have any leverage on.
Right.
And now he is a, as we've discussed in prior episodes, he's a cooperating witness with the government. So this is something that he's put out there, I think, as a means to try to help his case. The other big release was, of course, the FISA warrant and the information associated with it. And the Republicans, I think, at one point had thought that this was going to, I think, undermine the Russia investigation because it seemed to imply that the basis for the warrant, what was known as the Steele dossier, the Democratic National Committee had funded and hired a former British spy to essentially dig up dirt on Donald Trump. This guy was initially hired by one of Donald Trump's opponents during the Republican primary. But what it seemed to also verify is that there were other information there that corroborated why they were wiretapping. So the FBI doesn't look bad for doing this. So I think it kind of backfired on him as well. And all of this stuff leads up to the other great scandal, which is we have a bona fide actual spy. This is like a John Le Carre kind of, you know, movie going on right now, book going on right now, in Maria Butina, who I guess we can describe as a honeypot. Is that right, Brandon? Is that the right term?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think if you were to write this and submit it like to producers in Hollywood, they wouldn't believe it. It just seems too far-fetched, right? But altogether, it's such a bizarre series of events. But in this particular case, right, with this woman, she apparently had sort of offered conservative credentials. She had interactions with the National Rifle Association. The problem is that she was now apparently acting as an unregistered Russian agent, and there were allegations she has ties to the Russian intelligence community. So the issue here is not just that, you know, she's doing something which potentially is illegal, but that she had been connected to several key players in Washington, including the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve and also other Treasury officials. So there's a kind of web here that we see evolving. I don't know where this will go exactly or specifically, but I think in general, the reason this is important is because it gives sort of credibility to the claims from Democrats who want to say that essentially that Trump is sort of, you know, in the employ of Russians. If this was one event and it was isolated, it would be one thing. But the fact that it happens, and like we said, has happened multiple times, even in a week, there's a kind of growing sense that there is this problem. And I think that the president will be politically kind of vulnerable as a result.
Right. And all of this, the spy incident, the Cohen tapes, Carter Page, FISA reports, all of this is talked about in the news cycle incessantly. And it's been done, especially on cable news. And the president has reacted by it because he's upset about being talked about all the time, particularly by some of the talking heads and the pundits opining on it, many of whom are former Obama officials.
Right.
And so the president's now moved to try to puts out a statement that he wants to revoke all of their security clearances, even though half of them have already been revoked. But he's injected this into it, Brandon.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. He suggested that people like former CIA Director John Brennan, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, James Comey, CIA Director Michael Hayden, who are still talking about these issues, might have their security clearance stripped because, according to Sarah Sanders, they've politicized and in some cases monetized this for their public service. I think that's probably fair. Clearly downgrade this in a way that's not the same sort of code word sensitive, but it is also definitely the case that this reads like sour grapes, right? Like, don't mess with me or we're going to take this away from you. I think there are probably better ways to handle this, but I think that, to be honest, the White House seems to be operating on a kind of day-to-day basis right now. There's not a kind of long-term communication strategy, and I think that this is the wrong way to treat this, but this is maybe the best chance that they've got to be able to try to gain control of a message which is quickly spiraling away from them.
I like what Speaker Ryan said about this. I think the President of the United States, he's just trolling all of us.
Right.
He really is. This is just distract, you know, sort of put away. I'm just going to throw something else on because I don't want anybody else talking about Russian spies and FISA warrants and no, he doesn't want anyone talking about tapes.
I'm encouraged that Ryan knows what trolling is. Remember, this was the same Speaker of the House who didn't know what dabbing was. And
That's one
of the kids who was of the members being signed in dabbed after it. And Ryan was perplexed by what was happening. So
yeah,
next
thing you know, the Speaker will be involved in the Drake video challenge, the dance off there. Well, throughout all this going on, there's been a big policy implementation that came out. The president is proposing a new kind of farm aid, not the kind Willie and Mellencamp did back in the 80s. But because of the trade war that has essentially happened, the cost and the impact to farmers has been massive. So the president decided to put out a bill that is going to provide $12 billion in assistance. Now, the irony of this is a bit like someone burning down your house, but the person burning down your house happens to be the fireman, and he's going to try to put it out and then want credit for it.
Yeah, this has to be acknowledged by Republicans as being bad policy, right? I mean, they were against this kind of escalation of the trade war anyway, and the fact that now it's going to cost like double the money is definitely something that they don't want to run on. I don't know how to play out, but I can imagine there are a lot of Republicans who are economic level Republicans as opposed to kind of social conservatives who might look at this as being just an obvious problem when it comes to how the policy in terms of farming has been proffered.
Well, Brandon, let's talk a little Texas politics. As always, lots going on. Let's start off with kind of a gross story, to put
yucky,
it mildly.
Right?
Kind of yucky. So the State Health Service at the Austin State Hospital had an outbreak of mold. Now, there's great irony in this one, since these are the guys who are supposed to be tracking infectious diseases in Texas.
Right.
But 127 people are sick. There's a mold problem. Again, to me, the serious issue here is, this is a state government that can't really manage its resources well. I mean, you've had a series of scandals. This is not good for the governor. These are basic things that need to be managed well.
Yeah, the Texas Tribune reports that the state has spent over $16,000 on dehumidifiers to fight this mold problem. The problem that they can't fight, or at least haven't been able to fight, is just the sort of poor management of these agencies. Like you say, there has been serious scandals. In fact, one thing we missed while we were off is that there was a big problem at Health and Human Services. There was an award of upwards of about $3.4 billion in contracts that apparently weren't scored properly. So it's just a whole messy issue. I don't know. The mold is like growing in a really awful way. That's not just about the physical mold. It's also like a moldy government, right? And maybe it's an analogy that they don't want to play up. I think we're probably not going to hear a lot about this. I think it's unfortunate because this isn't the kind of thing that's really sexy in an election year, right? Politicians don't want to talk about it. Greg Abbott may have one debate, maybe two, with Lupe Valdez. Will it come up in that? I don't know. It's not the most stimulating issue for anybody, but this is what government does, right? They manage these agencies that are supposed to, you know, help run Texas.
Yes. Well, speaking of debates with Lupe Valdez, Dan Patrick decided to not have any debates with Mike Collier. Now, it's interesting. Mike Collier, who's a Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor, the polling is actually showing this race pretty close, in large part not because people really like Mike Collier. They don't know Mike Collier. It's because Dan Patrick is fabulously unpopular in Texas. And so as a consequence, this race is pretty much in the margin of error in several polls. The whole question here is that Dan Patrick, who is, you know, he has a TV radio background. He has never shied away from a fight. He's seemingly not wanting to have a conversation with the voters of Texas with Mike Collier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, the rule is when you're ahead, you ignore your opponent. And when you're behind, you attack. And so Collier makes, I think, a good point here. He needs to really get in the mix on this. But Patrick, who's got, what, $14 million in the bank to Collier's, I don't know, $400,000, which, you know, is not a bad sum for a statewide campaign when you're competing with resources for everybody else. But that differential is going to be problematic. I think that for Dan Patrick, he likes to control the narrative. And when you're on a stage with somebody else who's challenging you every minute, it's going to be hard for him to do. So I don't see him doing this. Alan Blakemore implied that Mike Collier doesn't understand politics or policy in Texas. I don't think that's true. But the way that they basically swatted them away was as insulting as like a mosquito buzzing around you. So I don't see this happening, but it should. I think just for Democratic purposes, we need to know where people stand on this. And I think most voters are never going to understand or see where Mike Collier is unless you're paying really close attention, and most people aren't.
Yeah, until Mike Collier can demonstrate he's two things. One, he can raise money to be competitive. And two, that this is a really close race. Yeah. And I think as we get closer in where there's genuine concern by the Patrick campaign, you're probably not going to see much of anything unless he's really forced into doing it.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, though, you've got another sort of political issue going on with Governor Abbott. He has been putting out what we call a tracker, a campaign tracker. He sends out someone to essentially video or film his opponent at any time. And so what he's been doing for even before the primary, he'd been sending out a young man who has been videoing Lupe Valdez at every public event. And we saw this before in other states. You're hoping to kind of catch your opponent, say something salacious on camera. Well, this guy, this poor campaign staffer, I think was pretty much accosted by a Democratic Party worker during a campaign event for Lupe Valdez. Got caught on film, and it's kind of gone a little viral here.
Well, look, I mean, there are two tactics, right, when you send these trackers out. Number one is to get something on your opponent. They slip up. They say something stupid. In cases we've seen in the past, they say something racist. So that's going to make it into an ad. The other thing is to provoke something like this, right, where you want there to be an interaction and you want to gain some sympathy for what happened. You know, you have somebody bullying you to get you out of there. So this is definitely something that's part of this puzzle. And again, I think the Lupe Valdez campaign didn't have anything to do with this, but the fact that it's sort of connected is problematic for them. And once again, it's not about how they get their message out. It's about them fighting a process story. And that's not where they're going to be. That's not a good position to be in.
Well, Brandon, a court case just ended related to Senate Bill 6 that happened back in the session, which essentially was a fetal burial remains bill. It was really controversial. I mean, essentially what the bill said was that the remains of any fetus, regardless of whether it is the result of an abortion or a miscarriage, would have to be buried and conform to Texas laws as it relates to burials. Really controversial, created lots of issues, a lot of discomfort for a lot of people. It's been enjoined in a federal court. It's now had a trial, a lot of ramifications to it. Mm-hmm. We talked about this in the past. Nationally, Brett Kavanaugh potentially could be a swing vote. These are the kinds of bills and issues that could go up to a new Supreme Court and make law.
Yeah. Yeah, so the real kind of core of this question is whether or not this policy creates an undue burden on the right to an abortion. So this is something which is now the current controlling law, right? And this is from the troika of the justices who kind of created this carve-out. As you say, this could create a new type of law, or maybe that undue burden standard goes away or is changed to something different. In this case, typically it's thought of as a financial issue, right? That's the way the Texas has argued it in the past. That is less impactful now because the state's not paying for it, or the people who are getting the procedures aren't paying for it. So they want to say that this is an undue burden on the emotions of the people, which is an interesting angle. I'm not sure how it'll fly. The financing on this is unsteady, though, because although they've relied on private networks to fund the burial of what was left over from these procedures, it was definitely the case that this is running out. And so it may be that that's not perpetuated forever. So it creates lots of interesting questions. But I think at the end of it, they're going to keep pushing this, right? There's no way that this is going to be the end of the story.
Yeah, the political issue for me, I think, is just that this is another example of an attempt to try to erode Roe v. Wade.
Right.
You're going to see this move forward, and you're probably going to see other bills like this.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about sort of the big little bombshell, local bombshell here in the Harris County area, and that Sylvia Garcia formally resigned. And what does that mean for not just her seat, but the potential of swinging Harris County? The blue wave might be building up a little more steam here in Harris County.
So, Jay, yeah, big summer blockbuster bombshell here. Sylvia Garcia, who was going to resign at some point since she's likely going to win her election to the U.S. House of Representatives, has said that she's going to resign and that she hopes the governor will call a special election that will coincide with the November election date. There's also a special election happening out in the San Antonio area and parts west from there. So it's kind of a summer of special elections. Let's talk first about Houston and about what's going to happen with this district. We've got a couple of candidates who have said that they are running, Cal Alvarado and Ana Hernandez, both Democrats who have connections to that area and whose district overlap with that area. So this is going to be a pretty interesting fight, right, internally, but also with some implications for what happens beyond that. So what's your take?
Yeah, I think the most interesting aspect is how well Sylvia Garcia sort of politically played this. She timed her resignation and when it would take effect in a way that essentially forces the governor to call a special right. election during November.
Yeah.
There's a provision in the law that says that once you resign, you can create your effective date, but the resignation in terms of for election purposes takes effect 8 days after he receives it.
Mm-hmm.
And that the election itself has to be scheduled at the next uniform election mm-hmm. date, which is, of course, November.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've suddenly done is create this really contested special election in the largest pocket of Latino voters in Harris County right at the time for the Democrats that you want.
Yeah.
So the big winner to me is not necessarily Sylvia Garcia, who sort of did it for the Democratic Party locally, but maybe Adrian Garcia and Harris County Democrats in general.
Yeah.
You're probably going to see a much bigger turnout among Latinos potentially. And Garcia, who's in a close race in a swing precinct here in Harris County, has a real shot of winning that precinct and through Garcia's actions kind of lifting
yeah.
other Democrats countywide, potentially creating a larger blue wave here in Harris County.
Yeah. I want to get your take on this, but my sense is that like Harris County and the Democrats here have been less successful at turning out the Latino vote than places like Dallas or Bexar County or Travis County or certainly the Valley. So I wonder if this is going to be something that really helps to cement the role of Harris County in elections in the future. Harris County traditionally has been sort of a swing county, right? I mean, it went for Clinton pretty big, but it was very sort of tepid for Obama in 8 and 12. So we're really, I think, seeing the kind of precipice here as to what Houston might do. This is the thing you think that's going to push us over. It's just a wealth of Latinos running good quality candidates who are funded well, and that's going to spur electoral turnout from Latinos.
Well, I just think that by having this special election when it's being done
yeah.
and having all that energy at the November level, because that's been the issue.
Right.
You don't typically have that much energy during a general election cycle because you haven't had that sort of national Latino or major statewide Latino candidate running at a time when it mattered. At yeah. least we haven't in Texas in a very long time.
Yeah.
And so you have that here at a local level, much like you're seeing a lot of energy on some of these congressional races, you can generate that here because anyone coming out to vote for Ana Hernandez or Carol Alvarado benefits Democrats in this county. So it's a smart move politically for Sylvia Garcia and Democrats locally. And I think the impact potentially could be that it could swing because you don't need very many, 1 or 2%.
Mm-hmm.
For folks like Adrian Garcia and countywide Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are others who have districts that connect to Harris County and areas that might be spurred as a result. So you definitely could see a lot of crossover support and, for lack of a better way of putting it, a wave, right? But who it's not maybe so good for is the loser in this, right? And so we were debating about this, and I should know better than debate legal issues with you, but there's a potential here that there could be a controversy when it comes to how the elections are broken out, right? So the election code says that a candidate cannot file for elections on the same place, on the same ballot for two or more offices. And so especially it says in quote that are to be voted on at one or more elections held on the same day. Your argument is that these are one is a special, one is a regular, so you could be on the same ballot. I don't know, though. It seems to me like the language is a little ambiguous, and there hasn't been a case like this. So I wonder if this could potentially hurt the party who have these two, at least, candidates who are, you know, rising stars.
Yeah, I don't think there's that danger here, because I think we've had similar situations where you've had specials and generals on the same day.
Yeah.
The trick here is, for Democrats in that area, is that if, for example, if you're encouraging people to vote straight ticket, and you want everyone to vote for the Democrat, that whoever does that still has to vote in this race.
Yeah, right.
And so as a consequence, they're really two separate ballots. The election day itself is the same day, but they're technically on two separate ballots, and I think there's a way to get out of it. So I'm not as concerned for Alvarado or Hernandez losing their seat, but I do think it makes for some interesting dynamics here, just how they're going to be dealing with it, because they're going to have to remind people, hey, you can't just vote for me once. You almost have to vote for me twice.
I think that's it. And the more confusing these get, the more difficult it is to get a high enough voter turnout. Of course, people will be there, so it'll be a natural fit. But at the same time, depending on how they structure this, it could be problematic. What about the difference between these two? I mean, assuming it'll come down to these two, I mean, there could be others who weigh in on the race, but these are the two clear front runners. Alvarado has been running for the seat for a long time. I mean, she ran against Sylvia Garcia when it was special election to replace Mario Gallegos. She's been raising a lot of money. Her last couple of FEC report, TEC reports have her well ahead of Hernandez in terms of how much money she's raising for her House seat. She's out quickly with a video that talks about Harvey and sexual assault victims and some legislation she's pushed there. So she's got a running start here. Do you think she's the front runner? Is it going to go clearly to a runoff potentially if the two of these are fighting through the remainder of the summer?
Yeah, no, I think she's definitely the front runner in this. The question is who else gets in the race. The challenge for Carol last time was that she was not perceived as the most progressive candidate vis-a-vis Sylvia Garcia.
Yeah.
I think you might see a similar thing like that happen before. Alvarado has been successful in Austin in large part because of her ability to sort of work across the aisle. She is famously close friends with State Representative Sarah Davis, and she's had a good relationship.
They have the blanket caucus.
That's right, the blanket caucus,
the
bipartisan blanket. That's right. And she's had a good relationship with Speaker Strauss, and that's helped her effectiveness. Ana Hernandez is much more, I think, traditionally aligned with some of the more progressive elements of the Democratic Party, and is very close to not just Sylvia Garcia, but she's very close to Armando Wale, who's the other sort of really well-known Latino Democrat in the area. So it'll make for an interesting race. I think it's Alvarado's to lose, but a lot of it depends on what happens, because if you get into a special election where there's a runoff, and that runoff's in December, the total vote changes dramatically. You and I both know this in terms of the dynamics. That could potentially swing in Hernandez's favor. But right now, I think it's Alvarado's to lose.
I think that's probably right. There's also election down San Antonio way, which I think is actually the name of a song, but in this case, not about the election, but about San Antonio. Roland Gutierrez and Pete Gallego are the kind of two front runners here. There's a Republican in the race who is named Pete Flores, who's also run in the past. There's actually, I think, a total of nine people running, so the vote's going to get split a bunch of ways. It's a weird time for an election. Gutierrez has been running for this for a while, and he spent a lot of money. In fact, he's outspent Gallego about $500,000 to about $100,000. So it's likely Gutierrez is going to run, but there's been some issues, right? Gutierrez has had some legal and financial issues. He also has had some tax issues like Lupe Valdez. So this has been a mudslinging campaign. You also have an interesting increase potentially in the Latino vote there, but it's going to get split a bunch of ways, in part because you have the brother of the member who's leaving, convicted felon Carlos Uresti, Tomas Uresti, is also running and therefore may carve off some support. People may think they're still voting for Uresti. Who knows, right? But it's kind of a mess out there. So what's your take on what's going to happen
out there? Well, this election won't be in November.
Right.
This will be earlier
this
in November.
This is like next week.
Next
right?
week, right?
Yeah.
And so my sense is that Flores is probably the one certainty in the runoff. He's the defined Republican in the race. I mean, he has some level of name ID. The question is, this might be one where the Republicans could try to sneak in a win. You get a win here. You get into that runoff. You get an even smaller turnout in a potential runoff. And then you get in a situation where you get only your voters, those high propensity voters, in some cases more who tend to lean more Republican, because this is a kind of a swing district.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans are not as outnumbered here as they are, say, in SD6.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we'll see what happens. But it's another interesting implication here. Abbott called this earlier. So maybe in this case, he'll take a different tact and call the 1-4 Garcia seat a little.
Well, remember, this was one where Uresti, he had to resign immediately because, of course, being a convicted felon and all. So his dynamic.
It hurts a career usually, right?
Indeed. Well, this is a little bit different. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you what we think is going to happen in both these races and what to expect in November.
So some interesting implications to the special elections, Jay. What's going to happen? What does it tell us about, kind of generally speaking, what's happening in Texas politics?
Well, I think the tactics of the special election politics, Republicans got a big advantage when what happened in San Antonio and the timing. I think Sylvia Garcia and Democrats learned that message and now have a big advantage here in Harris County for November. I'd look for Democrats to do well as a result of what Senator Garcia did.
I think the two biggest problems the Texas Democratic Party faces is that they need to build a bench and they need to build a base. So there's both good and bad to this, right? It's good because now we're seeing the fruit of multiple different candidates who are well-known and can raise money running. The bad news is they're running against each other, and it could be that there's some long-term ideological friction that creates some bad blood for the party. So this is the kind of growing pains of what's going on. But I think you're right. I think this is going to spur turnout, not only in San Antonio in that district, but also what's happening here in Harris County.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci, to our web team, Giselle Bueno, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the candidate, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.